I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992. Here from our perch in 2023, I am one of your hosts, Phyllis Goh.
I'm your special guest host, Emily St. James, sitting in for your regular host, ambiguously queer Jim Broadbent. My favorite thing about this movie is that, like, the dill thing is a reveal, but like, if you are like in queer culture, like, is he at a gay bar? And like because Jim Broadbent's there, you're like, well, Jim Broadbent, of course, that's fine,
straight as an arrow,
great man. So your brain's like, no, of course Jim Broadbent would not be at
With us today, freelance journalist Caitlin Burns and Oliver Ash Klein, co-hosts of the Cancel Me Daddy podcast, are with us today to talk about The Crying Game, I don't want to say a problematic movie. Is it a problematic movie? Should we deem it problematic, Emily?
We're canceling it today.
We're canceling it today?
We're removing the film from the internet. No, I like this movie. I'm just going to come out and say it. I don't think it's great. I think it has problems, but I like it. On the whole, I like it. So that's my... As a trans person, I have now exonerated it forever. No one can ever have another opinion.
I mean, listen, the world appreciates that. Neil Jordan in particular. Yeah. But I'll just say this. I saw this movie maybe in the early to mid 90s, had notions of it, but certainly had not sat down to watch it, you know, in a very, very long time. Didn't really remember that it's really an IRA thriller, and that ultimately that's kind of what the movie's on its surface is sort of about. And I would also say too that I didn't know that I'm not even going to call it a twist because I don't really believe it to be a twist, but the reveal of Dill is really like an hour from the end of this movie. So like, it's not the big ending thing. Mm-hmm. It's much more midpoint, and then it's Stephen Ray's character dealing with said reveal and grappling with his own, I guess, attraction to this person or feelings towards this person.
He's grappling, like, the whole movie is about his feelings about masculinity. Correct. And men and penises. Like, there's the scene where he has to help Forrest Whitaker pee, and you're like, oh wait, he's like terrified of other, and I don't know, there's a lot going on here.
Going on in this movie. But Caitlin, Oliver Ash, thoughts in general before I give a little bit of context?
Yeah, so I wanted to say I had never seen this movie before, literally yesterday before we're recording this. But having said that, I felt like I had seen the movie through all of the pop culture references to that quote unquote reveal scene, which I'm sure we'll get into at some point.
Oh yeah.
And I low-key was dreading watching this when I sat down. I was talking to some friends on Discord. I was like, I'm actually not really in the mood to watch this. And I actually came away like appreciating this movie in a way that was really surprising to me. Yeah, I think that's a good baseline to start with. I have a lot of conflicting feelings about this. But I enjoyed a lot more of this movie than I was expecting to.
Yeah. Yeah, sorry, Oliver, go ahead.
Yeah, I would say the same. I hadn't seen it before, and I had mostly, been aware of it from the very, I would say the scene in the middle is pretty yikes. And so my kind of understanding of the film was based around that. And so I was, I expected it to be worse than it was, but it is still quite bad. And so, yeah, having a lot of conflicting feelings about it.
I think that, you know, for me, I also, just to be clear, have very conflicted feelings about it. It is not a movie that I think is particularly, I don't even know that it's clear of its intent at times.
Seven out of five stars. Go ahead.
Sure. But I in the minimal amount of research that I did, I think, Emily, you probably did more than I did in terms of, digging deep into its release and the way that it was sort of delineated to the world at the time. But, you know, Neil Jordan didn't intend for Dill to be trans in his original script of the film. He kind of backed into it, which, you know, at the time, I guess, I don't want to say I can understand it, but I guess I sort of was like, okay, I guess he felt like this was an interesting thing to do. But because that intent isn't necessarily there, it feels a little flippant about it, which I don't know is necessarily a good or bad thing in a weird way. Like, I don't even really know how to juggle it.
Go ahead, Al.
Oh, I think one thing that as I watched it and I found out after watching it that Dill wasn't intended to be trans, but I watched it and I'm like, well, the way that the movie deals with her transness is not great. But in a lot of other ways, she's portrayed like women were portrayed in film around that time. It's very like manic pixie dream girl. It's very like that. And so it was this weird mix of like, oh, they're really... they're really focusing on her transness in a way that is yikes, but otherwise, you know, she's treated like a real woman, and treated in a way that is not great. It's, you know, how women were treated in film in 1992. But you know, it was very strange.
But it's also, I'll just want to say one thing very quickly, Emily. I think that Jay Davidson's performance is really lovely. Mm. Like, I think that, she's bringing something really genuine and loving and very charming, charismatic. Like, all of those things are there, the manic pixie dream girl stuff aside. I'm just speaking in terms of like the energy that she's portraying on screen. I think that she very much is deserving of her Supporting Actress Academy Award nomination.
Supporting actor, Phil.
Oh, my apologies. I wasn't sure when I said
here's
it.
The thing about Jay Davidson is that he is a cis gay man. However, he presents very androgynously. He seems to like be very comfortable with gender fluidity. So far as Wikipedia is aware, he uses he, him pronouns. So I'm going to do that throughout. But like, he is like someone who presents in a variety of gender contexts, which is, I think, why this performance is stronger than, you know, I don't know, like Chris Sarandon in Dog Day Afternoon, you know.
I mean, also a good performance for what it's worth, but I know what you're saying. The Jay Davidson thing I also find fascinating, and we'll get into it as we keep going. But I do think that you know, two performances and then saying fuck Hollywood, reasonable. I probably after those circumstances might too.
What if your two movies were Crying Game and Stargate? What if that was just like, I would be so proud of my, you know, like, what?
Listen, two for two, I'm done. But yeah, I do think it is, it's weird because, and you alluded to this, both of you alluded to this, in terms of the pop culture-ness of this film, and Emily referred to it on our email chain, you know, Ace Ventura maybe being the worst culprit of this really kind of awful portrayal of this movie. I was really kind of girding my loins for this film, being like, this is going to be a really brutal experience. And it's actually kind of not. And I only say that in the sense that I don't feel as though it is a... It wasn't as, outside of the one scene, which I do think is handled poorly in terms of the reveal, I do think by and large, this movie is, it's better than I expected it to be, I guess is ultimately what I'm coming to.
I think Neil Jordan is, as far as he's ever said, he's a cis straight guy, and he's had five kids with women, so he's obviously got some attraction to women. One, I think.
A lot of gay movies. Yeah. A lot of gay movies.
He makes a lot of movies. He makes a lot of movies about queer characters. He's fascinated by queer people, but he's fascinated about them in the way an outsider would be. But he's also like deeply compassionate as a filmmaker. So it's this like weird thing of influences where it's like everything he does in The Crying Game is the sort of thing a cis straight guy would be like, well, that's, you know, what it would be like to be a trans woman. But he does it with so much compassion that you're sort of like, for instance, the scene where Dill needs to go into hiding. So Fergus, you know, disguises her in Jodie's old cricket uniform and cuts off her hair and everything, so she's a little bit more boyish. And like, it still doesn't entirely work because, you know, she's not a boy. But yeah, like that scene is like the sort of thing that a cis straight guy would be like, well, here's what a trans woman would have to go through. And it's like so gross, but also you're watching it and both Jordan's direction and Davidson's performance are so like soulful that you're like, well, he's kind of selling it. So it's like this weird combination of kind of horrible content, but also like really lovely presentation that creates a real weird taste in one's mouth.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned. I'm glad you mentioned the haircutting scene because I think to me, okay, I had two visceral reactions to scenes in this movie, and one of them was not with the reveal. Actually, the first one was when Dill gets up on stage and starts singing The Crying Game. I had like a PTSD reaction from Ace Ventura, actually, because they play The Crying Game song during their just awful reveal, and that traumatized me as a kid when I watched it. So that was my first reaction. But my strongest emotional reaction throughout the entire film was when he was cutting her hair and she was sobbing. I've written about this before, but like the forcible cutting of trans women's hair is like the universal suppression mechanism that the world over uses against us. I've talked with trans women in the Middle East, and when they get arrested for being trans in public, the first thing they do when they get to the police station is they cut their hair. When trans women get thrown in men's prisons, the first thing they do is they cut their hair. You remember Chelsea Manning was in a military prison. She actually sued for the right to have longer hair, and I believe she lost that case. You know, while Emily's talking about, well, you know, this is a cis guy's idea of what a trans woman would have to go through to go into hiding, I agree with that. But I think there's like an emotional kernel of truth to it as well. And that's the scene that made me cry throughout the entire, like more than any other scene in the whole movie, that's the one that made me cry. And that was the most relatable that Dill's character was to me as a trans woman.
I do think that scene is really powerful on many levels. Obviously, everything that you're speaking of, Caitlin. I also just think, too, that there's something very almost primal about it to some degree, that I think that everyone is kind of tapped into, whether consciously or unconsciously. There's a lot kind of going on there. And I do think that there's no question, in my opinion, that Dill's the most fascinating character in the film. And I would argue, again, whether Neil Jordan is conscious of it or not, I do think is giving her the most complexity and the most kind of intentionality behind it. I think that Fergus's character, it's interesting. I was watching this film, and I don't know what you guys think of Stephen Ray, but like, he's always a little bit laconic to me as an actor. I never feel as though he's, it's not as though he's not fully engaged, because I'm sure he is, but there's something kind of flat about him to me. Mm-hmm. And I was watching this hoping for more kind of passion from him, and I didn't necessarily get it. And I don't know if that's his natural state. I actually think he's great in Interview with the Vampire, because he's playing it super broad and he's just like a mustache twirling villain, and it works. But in this, I just found myself just watching it being like, do you really care, man? I don't know. It was strange to me.
I like that performance. I think this movie's trying to do is another thing that like we kind of have to prop up against, which is, I forgot how much this movie's about Irish and UK politics of the early 90s. Forgot how much is about the IRA and the troubles.
It's Patriot Games
and
again.
Like it had a hugely kind of poor reception in the UK, because the critics there were like, this movie's politics are like so risible. And of course we watched it in the US, and like all we thought about was, you know, Dill's penis. But like, there's like I think he's trying to do some sort of metaphor with Dill for some sort of political thing. I don't understand, but I think it's like something about like your true nature, you know, coming to the surface, and like the ways in which it's very much, the whole movie is about the ways in which masculinity perverts and makes toxic these many things. And yeah,
it's all like identity politics in a weird way, right?
Irish,
like,
identity about, politics, like, yeah,
right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's kind of weird in that respect. I mean, that was the thing that the overarching sense I got from this film ultimately is that it's kind of two movies that don't totally work together, which is that it's bookended by 20 minutes to a half an hour of IRA politics and what's going on between the Irish and the UK. And then sort of sandwiched in the middle is this love story. So it does kind of feel at odds with itself, especially when you get to the end with the shootout and you know what I mean? All this sort of stuff where you're just like, what's really like, it is a little jarring. I'm not totally sure that it all kind of gels. And I also feel like it's worth, you know, I sort of loosely mentioned it earlier, but like, this movie got a lot of Oscar nominations. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. Got 6 Academy Award nominations: Best Picture, Best Editing, Best Actor, Best Supporting Actor, Best Director, Best Original Screenplay. It doesn't win any of them.
It won screenplay.
Did it really?
It won screenplay. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Mm-hmm. My apologies.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So it wins screenplay. So Neil Jordan is an Academy Award winning filmmaker.
Good for him. Honest.
Good for him. nothing against that. You know, we will inevitably have to talk of Voldemort, aka Harvey Weinstein, and what this film brought to the world. But I'm just sort of watching this film thinking to myself, you know, Emily and I did Malcolm X a few months ago, and you're just like, really?
This is a hot take. Malcolm X is a better film than The Crying Game.
Yeah, that's my point. I'm just like, what are we doing?
As research for this, I watched all of Siskel and Ebert, If We Pick the Winners, Oscars 1992, because they had a huge fight over this movie in that thing.
The best.
And like, most of it was cut out and apparently happened off camera. But
the little babies, those two.
The end of that special is them both bemoaning how Malcolm X wasn't nominated, and picking the worst nominee. And Roger Ebert's like, the worst nominee is A Few Good Men for Best Picture, because they passed over Malcolm X for this. And I'm just saying that because I know it'll make Phil mad.
God damn you. I mean, I'm sorry, but can we, I think, Emily, we can both agree that Scent of a Woman has
Scent
no
of a Woman is
there.
Absolutely the worst. Yeah, it's terrible. It's terrible. but no.
But it is just one of those things where I was just sort of like, you alluded to this earlier, Emily, but the American reception of this film feels so indebted to the reveal and the audacity, quote unquote, of this movie, and Miramax weaponizing that, mm-hmm. and the media weaponizing that to turn this film into, quite frankly, a sizable box office success, that kind of overshadows everything else. I do want to give a little bit of context for this film to the people that perhaps haven't seen it. Irish Republican Army member Fergus, played by Stephen Ray, forms an unexpected bond with Jody, played by Forrest Whitaker, a kidnapped British soldier in his custody, despite the warnings of fellow IRA members Jude, played by Miranda Richardson, and McGuire, played by Adrian Dunbar. Jody makes Fergus promise he'll visit his girlfriend Dill, played by Jay Davidson, in London. When Fergus flees to the city, he seeks her out. Hounded by his former IRA colleagues, he finds himself increasingly drawn to the enigmatic and surprising Dill. The Crying Game opened on November 25th, 1992, against Home Alone 2, Lost in New York, Aladdin, The Bodyguard, Bram Stoker's Dracula, Malcolm X, and of course, The Mighty Ducks. It would go on to make $71 million on a $5 million budget. It has 94% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 78% from audiences. I mentioned it obviously got a bunch of Oscar nominations. Entertainment Weekly in November of 97 magazine picked this as one of the 50 greatest independent films. Better read a little bit of Roger Ebert's 4-star review of this film, saying some movies keep you guessing, some movies make you care. Once in a while, a movie comes along that does both those things at the same time. It's not easy. Neil Jordan's The Crying Game keeps us involved and committed throughout one plot twist after another. It's one of the best films of 1992. Jordan's wonderful film does what Hitchcock's very different film also did. It involves us deeply in a story and then reveals that the story is really about something else. We may have been fooled, but so was the hero, and the plot reveals itself. We find ourselves, exactly, Oliver's faces, identifying more and more with him. The film is complex and labyrinthian, both in terms of both plotting and in terms of its matters to the heart that follow. Most movies' love stories begin as a given. We know from the first frame who will be together in the last. Here, there are times when we know nothing and times when we know less than that. Yet because we care about the characters, we can't help but liking them. It's surprising how the love story transcends all the plot turns to take on an importance of its own. The Crying Game is one of a very few films that wants to do something unexpected and challenging and succeeds beyond its ambitions. See this film, then shut up about it. I that was literally how he ends his review.
Like Roger had worked in the arts for some time and he had met queer people. He was aware that like queer people like could love.
It literally like cracks his head open and just like it's like this. It's like he'd never seen anything like this film before. I think he was so just gobsmacked by. And again, I don't want to say this word necessarily positively or negatively, but the audacity of this movie. I think he just truly was so taken with the gumption it had to do this. I don't know.
I mean,
oh my God, a trans woman on my film screen. Yeah, like,
it's crazy.
The trope of this person is this woman is actually, you know, not a woman or whatever, like that trope was already around at this point. And I think that what people thought was audacious about this is that it made Dill a human being in some capacity. She's mm-hmm. allowed to be a woman who the film treats as misogynistically as it would treat any other woman at that time in 1992, as Oliver alluded to. Right. And it's like so there is this element of, you read some of the press around this time, and reading it from a 2023 lens, you will note how many reviews just don't use pronouns to refer to Dill. They will refer to her as the hairdresser, you know, because they want to preserve the twist. But in their minds, you know, the reality of Dill's genitalia overcomes her gender identity. And it's 1992 and these are all cis people. So like in some level, I understand why they're doing that. But reading it from a 2023 perspective, like it's so wild. Because like if you read those reviews now, you'd be like, well, I know the twist. Like I know what this big reveal they're talking around is. But at the time, everybody was just like, well, of course, you know, Dill's gender is attached to what's in her pants. So it's this weird journey. But like, yeah, the fact that this movie treats her with compassion, and I love The Silence of the Lambs, which comes out a year before this, and that movie goes out of its way to be like, Buffalo Bill is not a transsexual, and then says that transsexuals are very passive, which is funny to me every time. But
you're very passive, Emily.
But that is a movie that while it has some space in its mind for the humanity of Buffalo Bill, is not particularly interested in it in the way that this is mm-hmm. with Dill. I do think that this movie was predominantly read as being about a gay relationship in 1992. And like that was a lot of the lens that critics, American mm. critics, to be clear, British critics were all like, why are you being nice to the IRA? that American critics were reading it through.
I think there is a gay love story in this movie, but it's not between Dill and Fergus. It's between mm. Fergus and Jody.
Mm-hmm.
100%.
Yeah. I was really struck by that, especially the one scene where like Dill is going down on Fergus, and at the climax he like imagines Jody like pitching the cricket ball to him or whatever, bowling. I think it's bowling. Yeah. I don't know cricket. It's like a weird foreign sport. So yeah. And the other interesting part of it too, because the whole movie is from Fergus's perspective, and the bar that all of those scenes take place in, the very clearly queer bar, which I picked up on immediately, like all of the patrons are depicted as very like cis passing in the first like couple scenes in the bar, and then after the reveal, the first scene in the bar, like you could tell every single person was queer coded in the bar, and I'm like, oh, that's kind of an interesting, vaguely problematic filmmaking choice to do. I very much got the sense of watch out, these people are hiding in plain sight if you don't pay attention to the details type of thing, which I think was a very common attitude in 1992. Yeah, and like you could do a supercut of this movie of just the love story scenes between Dill and Fergus and literally just call it The Chaser, because Fergus acts like every chaser I've ever met as a trans woman who dates cis men.
I was thinking about this movie from Dill's perspective, and I, you know, when they launched the Crying Game universe cinematic universe, and I am invited to make Dill origins. This movie from Dill's perspective is interesting because she has a similarly huge reveal that we don't perceive as a reveal because we followed Fergus from the first, but she learns that like her boyfriend killed her previous boyfriend, which is like a pretty big thing to learn. And yeah. Like, I do think,
did he technically kill him?
I mean, he chased him in front
British
of a truck.
Killed him because the British yeah. are evil and up the yeah. IRA. And
listen,
no, sorry, my Irish ancestry jumped out. Listen, I apologize.
Listen, I have no, at this moment in time, I don't find the British particularly sympathetic for some reason as a trans person. One complaint I have about this movie is that I think it would be a stronger story if Fergus had killed Jody. I get the political yeah. implications of the British having run over their own soldier, but like I think that that would add more guilt. But yes, he's aware of the death of Jody. He was complicit in it to some extent. And so that's like a huge thing for Dill to find out. And also to find out that, you know, from her perspective as a British citizen, that like he's a member of like a terrorist organization. Like the biggest reveals in this movie are from her perspective. And for as much as I agree with Caitlin's read of this as presenting the bar as like, oh, they're hiding in plain sight, I do think Jordan is using the bar as a way to like not make Dill such a reveal. When she says, I thought you knew, didn't you know? Like, of course she thought he knew. That's, you know, this bar is for people who are queer or are, you know, chasers. And it is the thing that he sort of, I think this, the reveal in this movie is not supposed to be as big of a reveal as it's been sold as. I think a lot of the problems with this movie has problems, to be clear, but I think a lot of the problems with its legacy are from the marketing and from the movies that followed in its footsteps. If it was just kind of like a weird example of early 90s transphobic storytelling, we would be like, Yeah, but like also Dill gets to be a whole human being, which was really rare at the time. And yet it wasn't like this whole like cottage industry built up around not revealing the twist, which again, within the context of the film, is not much of a twist.
Well, go ahead.
I was going to say, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is kind of the like story of vomiting after finding out this man hooks up with a trans woman. It's like they Thanos snapped that into existence.
Yep, they did.
And it's not just Ace Ventura. It's Family Guy. It's Naked Gun. Like the list of works that came out in the immediate aftermath will blow your mind. And I've written about most of them, and I've watched and forgotten most of them. The Netflix documentary Disclosure does a really great breakdown of all of this too. That was a source of surprise for me in that like I didn't think this film was I thought this film was like a fraction as transphobic as all of the like later like trans vomiting trademark scenes like made it out to be.
I guess like I've been thinking that one of the like the biggest failure, at least in my eyes, of this film in the way that it's told is that Fergus is like the nice relatable guy and not portrayed as someone who has not worked through his shit and who has to deal with his own shit and is hurting people because of it. Cause he's portrayed as such a sympathetic guy who's just trying to do the right thing. And you know, those things may be true or whatever, but he's still got his shit to work through and he's taking it out on other people and he kind of sucks. And so I wish the film portrayed that part of it. Cause I think it would have been a lot stronger.
It's implicit in a way where I think it needed to be made explicit once or twice. Like I do think the scene where he's struggling to help Jody P makes a lot. There's a lot more there in retrospect, but it happens so early in the film that you're like, well, yeah, I mean, I've never had to help someone else pee. Seems like it might be tricky.
To underline what you were saying, Oliver, that this film ends, you know, whatever, we're talking about it out of order, but like with him in prison, right, having taken the fall for Dill murdering Jude, and he seems like pretty okay with it. Like the final scene between him and Dill is playful, ultimately.
They're kind of coupley. Like confirmed that they're a couple, but it certainly seems like they're at least in each other's lives to a real extensive
extent. I agree with that, but I also get the impression that on some level, Fergus is like, yeah, I guess I belong here. I guess this is okay. Like, he just seems very okay with this literal prison that he's in. And it does feel as though he's just such a kind of introverted and kind of self-loathing person that on some level you're just sort of like, he seems content with the fact that like, yeah, what's another prison? I'm in a prison anyway of my mind. I mean, I might as well be in a literal one. It's odd to say the least. What? And played, to your point, Emily, as kind of coupley, kind of sweet. He's regaling her with the story of the scorpion and the frog that Jody tells him at the beginning of the film, which, you know, obviously isn't coincidental. And you're just sort of like, I guess they're making it work. I don't really get it. Like, I don't really get the final vibe that we're left with in terms of the arc of Fergus's character and whether or not he feels like this is penance for something.
My interpretation of it was he was okay with the prison time because he felt like he deserved it for his Jody's part in death. Jody's death.
Yeah.
And also he fulfilled Jody's wish of taking care of Dill by also taking the fall for her, even though like I think
he also subjected Dill to a lot of
I don't think Dill did anything wrong problems. Like I think, you know, the IRA woman whose name I have forgotten, I apologize, kind of deserved to die. Yeah, Jude kind of deserved to die. I
didn't
stand her from the beginning.
Miranda Richardson, great though.
Oh yeah, I mean, no, performance was amazing because, you know, she made me hate her from
yeah,
the start.
Yeah.
But like the murder that Dill, you know, committed at the end was entirely instigated by Fergus. If Fergus hadn't made the decisions that he made throughout the entire film, Dill wouldn't have killed anybody, I don't think. The other thing too is it did bother me a little bit that there's a trans woman killing somebody on screen again, which is such a played out trope. And it was a theme of movies at the time that had trans women in it. You know, who is it that Michael Caine played? Which movie was that where he was
Dressed to Kill?
Dressed to Kill, yeah.
Dressed to Kill, yeah. That's another one that came to mind. And of course, Psycho is the originator, I think, of that idea.
Yeah.
And you mentioned Silence of the Lambs, which also sort of plays with that idea. So I didn't really appreciate that, especially because of the fact that, like, this is all Fergus is doing. Like, he did this.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, yes, Psycho originates that trope, but it is based on like a misunderstanding of what happened with real life serial killer Ed Gein, who is like the stories about Ed Gein, which were largely made up, like form the basis of so many different serial killers of so many different vintages in fiction. I'm not even going to keep talking about Ed Gein. This is not Ed Gein cast, though it should be. I think is interesting about Dill is that the film sets her up as a femme fatale because it is broadly speaking a noir. So like it slots her into that role in like a really like standard way, but then it also is sort of like interested in the way that her role as a femme fatale is complicated by her being a trans woman, but also like not as interested as it maybe could be if it was from her perspective. But yeah, like, so in that sense, the ending of the movie, him taking the fall for her is like an interesting inversion of a classic noir trope. I don't know, you know, her just like suddenly killing someone and like just like gunning them down. I'm like,
cold blood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Seems, yeah. Although I will say, if somebody forcibly cut my hair, I would also be kind of murderous. I'm not gonna lie.
Yeah.
I think it's worth also noting, to your point, Emily, that, you know, one of the things mixed into Dill's hatred of Jude is the fact that Jude is biologically a woman, right? Or however you want to call it, right? Mm-hmm. She talks about the way that she seduces Jody. Right, that she used her feminine wiles or her body in order to seduce him. And that creates a whole other kind of, I would argue, problematic layer to this, that like her killing Jude for being however you want to call it, this sort of.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
it I don't even want to say it's a self-loathing, but there's something going on there that feels not great to me, in terms of her hatred towards Jude for that. Mm-hmm. That stuff also feels very, I don't know, messy to me, and not great. Don't like it.
I sent out a bad link in my newsletter this morning, and now it's not working for anybody. And so I'm just like, this is just, I'm having to deal with that as we're talking about the Crying Game. And my baby's daycare is canceled today, and she's screaming in the other room. This is a great time to be talking about the Crying Game. That's all I'm going to say.
I'm sorry.
No, you're fine, Phil. You're fine, Phil. It's just life. I like to talk about my personal problems on our movie podcast.
As you should. I guess I just wanted to kind of highlight that because I do the Jude component, mm-hmm. because I do feel as though, again, this is when I felt like the film's written by a cis white man shows itself most glaringly in terms of a lack of understanding of the complexities of it.
It's a cis person's understanding of the surface level of trans people's lives. The sort of seducing with feminine wiles thing is very common sort of taunt that comes from transphobic cis women, particularly. You see this a lot on Twitter where viciously anti-trans people are like, I just gave birth. This is something that a trans woman can never have. And I'm like, you just had a child. Shouldn't this be the happiest day of your life? Leave me out of it. What's your problem? Right. So I think that is very much a cis lens type of deal. It's like a claim to womanhood, that is almost like a trump card for a lot of transphobic cis women. And it is problematic to portray Dell as, being motivated in part by that, in murdering the cis woman lead, supporting actress, supporting character, excuse me, at the end of the movie. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, and again, I not to state the obvious, but the anti-trans notion is so superficial when everything is said and done. And again, it comes back to sort of people looking for easy answers to things and wanting to sort of, I mean, listen, I am Canadian, and I bring this up only to say that the way mental health is handled in Canada, I would argue, is considerably better than the way it's handled down here.
What?
And I think a lot of it, I know,
there's
crazy.
Something that's wrong with the United States of America.
I know. I'm sorry. But I do think that so much of it comes down to the fact that the messiness of emotions and of feelings and of identity and all these things, there's just such a swath of this country that has no interest in dealing with those things. Mm-hmm. And they just want everything to be tactile and physical. So it just becomes so kind of binary and black and white. And I think that this particular portion of the film, that just feels very writ large to me, that it was necessary for it to be something in our physical universe rather than something that is emotional. I think does a huge disservice to the character.
I just want everyone to know that I googled Neil Jordan TERF, and it appears he's fine. It appears
great.
He's fine. Right.
Glad to hear it. I do think you brought up Neil Jordan, and it's worth just talking for a quick second, because I do think the guy has somewhat fascinating career.
I kind of love Neil Jordan.
I do. I mean, I do too. I think he's got a lot of, weird movies that I'm not sure he's really dealing with particularly.
Kind of every movie he makes is problematic in a weird way, and the weirdness overcomes the problematicness for me. So I'm just like, what the fuck are you doing here, Jordan? I love you. Come give me a hug.
I mean, I feel like there's definitely. It's funny that you bring that up, Emily, because there's a part of, I'm looking at his filmography right now, and I'm like, this is kind of an Emily filmography. And I say that in the way that all these movies are kind of
messed up
metaphors for other things, messy and kind of crazy, like Company of Wolves, his sort of his first
film.
Oh
my God, I love that movie.
God, that's what I'm saying. Like, this feels like a classic. It's like a fairy tale horror movie, mm-hmm. A sort of Little Red Riding Hood thing that comes out in 84. Mona Lisa, which is a legit great film with Bob Hoskins, it comes out in 86. We're No Angels. What are your thoughts on Weirdo Angels, Emily?
You know what? I've actually never seen Weirdo Angels, but it sounds like a movie I'd love because it's, you know.
It kind of does. It's from Neil Jordan. Sean Penn, De Niro, Demi Moore, and written by David Mamet. Just like, where they're pretending to be priests.
Great.
I don't know. Then you've got The Crying Game, obviously. Interview with the Vampire, which I adore. I know. I don't know. Are you a fan of Interview with the Vampire, Emily?
I like it. I think it. Oh, okay. I think it loses. I'm trying to remember why. I think it loses something after Kirsten Dunst kind of leaves it. Like, I think
she's in it for most of it, but I know what you're saying.
But there's something it loses like 30 sure. minutes from the end. And I can't remember exactly what it is, but
I hear you. I get it. Someday I hope to talk about that film in more detail. Michael Collins, sort of a biopic-y.
That's a bad movie.
Liam Neeson,
that's a bad
Oscar
movie.
Play.
It's sorry, not a good Neil. Movie.
In Dreams, do you have thoughts on that one, Emily?
I kind of love In
yeah,
Dreams.
I saw that coming.
It's such a huge mess.
Such a mess. We talked about that on our 99 podcast. End of the Affair, I think, is legit underrated. I think
good
that movie's.
Yeah,
a really good movie. The Good Thief, interesting. Nick Nolte playing kind of a casino
and that
guy.
That movie has a legit trans woman bodybuilder in it, and she's not fetishized in any way. It's just sort of like, look at this. She's part of the team. I'm interested in his relationship to trans people because it's all over the fucking map.
It's all over the place. I mean, Breakfast on Pluto is another. Trans but sort of drag with Cillian Murphy in this kind of I don't even know what the gender play is in that film.
I actually want it because Neil Jordan does a lot of trans characters, but he tends to portray them through drag, and of course trans people do drag all the time. It's fine. And drag is a way that a lot of people discover they're trans, but I'm just sort of interested in our guests' thoughts about the intersection of trans identities and drag, because that's often how Neil Jordan gets to talking about trans people, is like thinking about drag.
He's also not alone in that respect.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I'm just like, I'm trying to tie it to the theme of the episode.
No, for sure. I mean, to your point, Emily, I feel like Neil Jordan seems fascinated with gender roles. Mm-hmm. I know that's a broad term, but that sort of notion of how men and women deal with being men and women as you know, whatever. Then you have The Brave One, which is sort of his last film that's of any note, really, with Jodie Foster, which again, also about sort of, you know, trauma and this woman dealing with it's all.
I did sort of specifically want to hear our guests' thoughts on this question of the intersection of drag and trans identities. I love your thoughts, Phil, but I talk to you every day. So,
I think it's so complicated.
Okay. I just drop a bomb into the middle of the
just throw a grenade into this conversation and see how it goes.
I mean, so I think that a number of trans people find their identity sometimes through drag, right? Because it's a more it's a way to express femininity, right? In a way that is kind of, at least in like cis gay circles, like culturally acceptable, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, there's a lot of like gender fucky, incredible drag that's happening right now. That's not kind of the traditional drag, but also, you know, drag can often be very trans misogynistic and misogynistic. And is kind of can be the performance of femininity and can be very transphobic. And so I think it's this very complicated part of queer culture that has a lot of beautiful, innovative things in it where people can express themselves and find themselves and try on different things. And it can also be deeply harmful. And I think it's just very complicated.
Can I ask a question? Because I mean, as a cis white male, I'm coming at this just from obviously my stupid perspective, but
it's not stupid.
I appreciate you saying that. But I do think that I guess what I'm asking is, drag has also been weaponized of late.
Absolutely.
The right has taken it as, you know, a gateway drug of some sort that I don't completely understand. And I guess my question is sort of about, there is a playfulness and a really kind of lovely expression through drag that doesn't even necessarily have a sexual connotation to it. And yet, why do you think it has been weaponized in the way that it has?
I want to hear our guest thoughts, but I'm going to talk now, apparently.
Please do.
I'm fascinated by this because as recently as a couple of years ago, drag seemed like the one queer thing that like cis mainstream cishet society was like, yes, we think this is interesting and fun. And like, I had some issues with the way it was commodified, you know, RuPaul's Drag Race becoming this weird institution has some problems that come with it, you know, just given who RuPaul is. The fact that every single streaming platform was like, we've got to have a reality show about drag queens that was then like the same generic thing about like living your truth and blah, blah, blah. But like it was accepted for better or for worse. And now like, it does feel to me like a weird tactical error that like this is the thing Republicans are attacking, but it is very much like trans people in general subvert and complicate and make the gender binary, you know, challenge the gender binary. But I am not doing any of that. Just speaking in terms of like my presentation, I'm a very traditionally feminine woman. Like if you see me at out in the world, I don't seem, you know, I'm not articulating myself well, but I'm not like someone who's challenging your idea of femininity in any real way. Whereas drag is like directly confronting the contradictions and the bad things about gender and showing the performance for what it is. And I think that that is easier to attack. And also, I think that a lot of conservatives just think all trans people present like drag queens. They aren't aware that trans men exist. They aren't aware non-binary people exist. They aren't aware that trans women, such as myself, exist. Like it's very much just like, oh, it's some guy in a wig and a dress and he's putting on a really silly voice. And drag is a place where we interrogate our attitudes towards gender. And I think there are a lot of people in this country who don't want to interrogate those attitudes because they benefit from them for some reason. So that's like a one sentence answer after seven paragraphs. Caitlin, you look like you had something to say.
Yeah, I'm just reflecting on like my own personal attitude towards drag. Like drag was never really my thing. I remember very early in my transition, like the first couple of times where I like ventured out of the nest as Caitlin, and I was still in the closet and I had a gay coworker and we were going to like gay bars in Portland, Maine, which like might as well be Siberia. There was a drag show that we would go to because it was like every Friday or Saturday night at this one place and it was a very queer friendly place to be. So like I thought I'd be safe. And I think the place even closed down since then. And I remember one time I went out and we were sitting there, we were watching the performance, and like I wasn't that into it. Like again, I was never a drag person. I've never watched an episode of RuPaul's Drag Race. I kinda can't stand RuPaul, but that's a story for another day. And I remember like the lead like queen on stage, like during one of her breaks, she came out into the audience and like approached me and she's like, hey honey, do you want to like get up on stage? And I remember being such a bitch to her. Like I was like, no, I'm like a real trans woman. And I'm like 2 weeks, like 2 months on HRT. It was a really problematic response. And she looked at me with like pity, actually. And it sticks with me to this day. And she's like, yeah, like three of those girls up there are on estrogen. Like, who the fuck are you? And it actually changed my perspective on this. And I'm still not a drag person. But it challenged my ideas of like the gender binary within the queer community. And it's caused me to do a lot of introspection about how I view drag queens. And it's sort of interesting that we're in this political moment now where they're being attacked right alongside us. Like, the existence of drag queens in public, I think, is inherently tied hand in hand with the existence of trans women in public, and where one is banned, the other will also be banned. So we need like solidarity, and I think that kernel of solidarity started with that frankly embarrassing moment that I had in that bar all those years ago. So these are sort of the things that are on my mind, and I got like the vibe actually watching The Crying Game, where I was like right back in that bar where I was like sort of viewed myself as an outsider, and I was coming into this space that was queer. I think there were explicit drag queens in the bar in The Crying Game. Was it the Metro, which I thought was a great name for like for a bar, because I'm obsessed with public transit, but that's also a story for another day. And yeah, I strangely related to Fergus a little bit in those moments where he was like realizing that this is like a drag queer bar.
Yeah. Yeah. I
go ahead. I'm listening.
I certainly like there is periodic. I think that when you are coming out as a white trans woman, there is a lot of like privilege that you have to like examine that you've always had, and that you're not losing any of your white privilege. That just sticks with you. But the fact that you are like suddenly leaving behind the comforting embrace of a patriarchy that has always sort of like propped you up, even if you have no idea what to do with it, you have to like interrogate that and examine that. And drag is often like threatening to that, because in some way, like another thing we haven't really talked about is drag is very inherently tied to queer people of color. In many ways, like a lot of the history of drag runs straight through things like the drag balls in the 80s and 90s, which were very much the products of Black and brown people, often trans women, sometimes cis gay men who were performing in that sense. So like it is inherent to queer communities of color, and periodically some just freshly out trans woman goes on x.com, formerly known as Twitter, and says, you know, I don't like drag, blah blah blah, but like just, like drag is so important to the history of queer culture, and particularly queer cultures of color, that like it is I think it's important to understand it. And I do think that the pushback against it is more broadly a pushback against trans identities, but is very much rooted in the fact that like this is inherently an outsider art that is done in opposition to the mainstream, to point out the mainstream's flaws. And that it, you know, it only could have emerged from the communities and the time period, again, which the AIDS HIV crisis in which it did.
So I have some thoughts about kind of where this is coming from. I think that the first headlines that I saw about the kind of anti-drag pushback and the first things that I kind of saw happening was around like story hour at libraries specifically. And I think that in a lot of the pushback that we're seeing about trans identities and trans folks is anything to do with youth. And so I think that, you know, drag was seen as something that was family friendly, right? To some extent. And I think a lot of the pushback comes from that and fear around children seeing people existing in different ways, not conforming to kind of this, you know, Christian nationalist idea of what a person and a family and a life should be, and anything outside of that. Is largely, you know, there's a lot of pushback against it. And so I think that that's kind of where some of this comes from. And I also want to say that I think that, you know, I said something a minute ago about some drag being you know, transmisogynistic and misogynistic. And I'm not sure actually where I stand. I think that that's like a viewpoint or an idea that I had from a past version of myself. And I'm not quite sure where I am on that right now. So just wanted to flag that.
I think all art forms have versions that are misogynistic and transmisogynistic, you know, but I appreciate you saying that.
I feel like, certainly on the subject of misogyny, we'd be remiss not to talk about the Harvey Weinstein component of this.
Oh God, I forgot we had to talk about him. I was just sitting here. Yeah. Just like...
I'm sorry. I know. It needs to be said just in the sense that this is the tip of the spear for Miramax. This is the first film to really break through in the United States to sort of, for them to sort of pluck this, smaller movie, small independent film out of quote unquote obscurity, bring it stateside, and it's a hit. I mean, 70 plus million dollars on what I can imagine was a relatively small investment, really is the snowball that starts rolling down the hill that turns into this massive corporation.
It's really interesting. If you read the history of Miramax, they had a pretty big success in 89 with My Left Foot, which gets a number of nominations, wins for Daniel Day-Lewis and Brenda Fricker. And then they have a couple lean years when they can't get anything going and they're like running out of money. And then The Crying Game comes along and is a massive success. And even more importantly, like breaks through at the Oscars in a huge way. And then they just run the table for like a decade. And Harvey Weinstein, a certified trash garbage human being.
Bad human.
We don't need to go into his crimes because they're awful and evil. No. But if you need to know, Google him, I guess. Don't do that. Yeah. He's a bad person. Yeah. Just take my word for it. But like, the things about this movie's legacy, we talked about the Ace Ventura Family Guy of it all, but also Harvey Weinstein invents the twist. He invents it in marketing because he saw some critics talking about it as a twist. The great critic, mm-hmm. Caden Mark Gardner, who writes a lot about trans film from his perspective, has done a lot of research into this and is basically like, Harvey Weinstein's the reason we talk about this movie. Like, there's a huge twist in it. And even after the Oscars, after Jay Davidson's nominated for Best Supporting Actor, which in theory should give away, quote unquote, the twist, Harvey's still pushing it. He's still like, there's a twist in this movie you don't want to know in advance. And again, in terms of like, if you're a queer person and you watch this movie, you're not that surprised that Dill is queer in some capacity. But also, if you are a screenwriter and watch this movie, like that reveal happens at the midway point. It is not a twist. It's not like a thing that puts the whole movie in a new perspective. It is a story beat that the characters have to deal with. It's so weird, this movie's reputation. And again, that scene is, as Oliver so eloquently said, yikes. But its placement within the movie suggests that it's intending to like push the story in a new direction rather than have us gasp and scream like Ace Ventura.
It's, you know, in terms of Miramax as a company, you know, you mentioned it, Emily, that like it's struggling. Crying Game is a big hit. It's also, you know, we've talked about the Reservoir Dogs as well on another episode. That's the moment when obviously they get in bed with Tarantino, which is obviously incredibly beneficial to them. They have The Piano, which is probably their next big thing in 93. And then obviously, as we all know, 94 is Pulp Fiction and Clerks and all of that. And then they're off to the races. But it is worth kind of underlining how sort of weaponized this movie was, how Harvey and Bob, I'm assuming as well, both understood that this twist reveal, however you want it, you know, that is the motivating factor behind this film's success is in weaponizing that moment of the film. A scene that we all, I think, can agree is arguably, I don't want to say the worst scene in the movie, but it is just not It's just not executed well.
I do wonder, in a world where this scene hadn't been weaponized, if we would look at it and just be like, yeah, that didn't work. Like that for the time, even for the time, that was not a great presentation. But because it's taken on this cultural relevance, where I've seen that scene dozens of times pulled out of the movie. Yeah. I've seen this movie twice now. But it's so like I've seen this movie before and remembered that being far deeper into the film than it is. It's there is a legit love story between Fergus and Dill after that scene. He has to there's a scene where he's like, I'm overcoming my prejudice. And it's the most ham-handed like thing you've ever seen. But it's there.
For good or bad, this movie is trying to wrestle with some stuff. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, you have to sort of give the film some credit for attempting to do what it's doing. It's not, you know, but Caitlin, you look like you had something to say.
Yeah, I'm glad we came back to this, actually, because it ties in with an earlier thread thought that I had. Mm-hmm. Where I said you could do a supercut of this movie and call it The Chaser. And what I meant by that is I was really struck by Fergus always refusing to allow Dill to like call him honey or darling after the reveal, whereas before it was fine. But at the same time, Fergus, after the reveal, is not afraid to have intimacy with her. And that, to me, is like the thing that fucking, excuse my language,
every
chaser I've ever like dated, quote unquote, if you want to call it dating, because they don't do traditional dating, they do some other weird shit, like that is literally the most relatable thing in this whole movie, where he's like, yeah, like I'll kiss you, like I'll, you know, I'll touch you, I'll hug you, I'll be your emotional support, but no, you can't call me honey, you can't call me darling, we can't be in a relationship because that's gay. And it's like, you still have some shit going on. But I thought that was actually very realistic.
Yeah, I it's interesting you bring that up, because I also found myself sort of really feeling for Dill during that portion of the film. Because you could, her feelings for Fergus seem genuine. I do believe that she is in love with him to some degree or another. And this arm's lengthness that he's created, that Fergus has created with Dill, is so hurtful, you know, and very kind of, I don't even know how cognizant he is of how offensive it is.
To return to an earlier point Oliver made, like the thing that is most misogynistic about this film is that Dill seems to only have like one guy she cares about in the like, she's a very beautiful woman, she could probably find a different boyfriend who doesn't treat her like that, but like Fergus is the protagonist, therefore she is very like dedicated to making sure everything goes well for him. So to the degree that she like kind of like doesn't murder for him, but like it's in a situation where
there's also
this movie does not pass the Bechdel test, by the way.
That does bring up for me anyway, there's that other guy that she's in, I don't know if it's a relationship with, who's just straight up abusive, mm-hmm. who's kind of crashing in her apartment, who like there's that whole thing that also feels sort of, I don't know if it's a transactional relationship or what's going on between them, but it also feels muddy and weird.
I mean, who hasn't dreamed of smashing and murdering a chaser's goldfish?
This movie's like weirdly savvy about the things that trans women face trying to enter into romantic relationships with men without realizing it's savvy about it. We never see Dill and Jody's relationship, but it seems like they had a genuine love. And now that he's gone, she can't find a guy who like will treat her with any amount of respect. And it's
If I was Dill and a guy came along and was like defending me from this abusive shithead that won't go away in my life, like, fuck, I'd be hooked for life. Like, I'm not gonna lie.
I would absolutely fall deeply in love with British accent Forrest Whitaker. And I would also, if he died, I'd be like, I guess it's Jim Broadbent time. Got to make that happen.
I mean, Jim Broadbent, who's giving a performance that I don't really know what to make of it. Cause like, I don't know what he's doing in this movie. He's just sort of, I guess he's a conscience of sorts.
Yeah. My favorite scene is when Dill and Fergus are flirting through him and like they're sitting on opposite sides of the bar and he's it's such a nice little scene.
It is.
Like there's so many good ideas in this movie, and then there's the rest of it.
There's so much. There's like that moment when Broadbent wants to quote unquote warn him of Dill and sort of explain the situation. You know, there's that terrible joke on the construction site with Fergus where they talk about how she's not a lady, that whole thing. There's just a lot of like weird kind of winky shitty jokes that are in the film as well that feels performative in a way that I don't even really know how to sort of, I just don't even know what Neil Jordan's doing there.
Oliver, you seem like you had something you wanted to
say.
I just, you know, I wonder what it would mean if this movie just portrayed Fergus accepting Dill as she was and being respectful of her. Like, culture and media are so intertwined, right? Like, we are so intertwined in that, like, good media can change people's minds or can show people a different way. And so, like, while this is very real, right? While I think that Fergus's, you know, reaction and how his, you know, he's a shitty guy dealing with shitty stuff and needs to work through his shitty bullshit. this is stated so eloquently. You know, what if he was someone who had worked through his bullshit? And, you know, treated Dill with respect and kindness and acceptance. And what would it, I don't know. I want to see more media of trans women being accepted and loved and cared for. And, you know, I know it was 1992 and all media can't be all things, but this was a pretty, pretty influential film. And you know, maybe it wouldn't have been as influential or as big if Dill was treated with the respect that she deserved, but it just makes me sad that she wasn't.
In reading a lot of the reviews of this movie, they take the tack that Ebert took, which is this plot is so complicated. You won't believe, and the plotting is actually not that complicated. Like, it is, you do have to keep in your mind all the stuff that happens in the first 20 minutes through this whole love story. Like, it's not that hard because they keep reminding you of Forrest Whitaker. So when Miranda Richardson comes back, you have to remember who she is, even though she's wearing a wig, which, you know, is very confusing for those of us who recognize people by their hair. Yeah. It's not that complicated. And the thing about it is it's just complicated because people had never heard of a trans person before. So
I'm going to say something a little bit controversial, but the love plot reminded me of Pearl Harbor, of all things, with the, like, the like death and love story. And that makes me very weird, and I acknowledge that.
That's
great.
My only memory of Pearl Harbor is that when the character in there's a moment when a character in it is like, you're like, oh, that person's probably going to die. My wife leaned over and said, they're going to bury him in the backyard. And then they did.
They literally did.
I wanted to highlight something from the end of the film that I think is worth noting as we wrap this up. But I do think that Dill ties up Fergus and sort of has this moment where she's kind of railing at him for what he's done, but also for every person that's treated her poorly in the past. And she says something along the lines of, everyone thinks be nice to Dill and she'll be yours forever. And there is sort of that kind of self-hatred that she's put on herself, that she's not deserving of love, and that there's some sort of a performative component to it that I think is just really heartbreaking and also sort of powerful in its own way too, that she's sort of grappling with that stuff. That I like, again, this all just goes to show that I don't think that this movie is not saying and doing interesting things, but I also just feel like it's all over the place and it doesn't really know how to kind of streamline it. But what did you guys think of that scene?
As a trans woman who also believes she's unlovable, I've actually tweeted about this many times.
Yeah.
I interpreted the tying up scene as her sort of reasserting control over her surroundings, which she's never really had control of over the course of the entire movie. Fergus never really gives her a straight answer on anything. Like, I think she just finally had enough of all of that, and like tying him up was the only way that she saw. But again, that's also problematic because it plays into tropes and public ideas about trans women being sort of always on the edge of doing something violent.
The center of the movie, the core of every one of its problems, is that Neil Jordan has a cis guy's understanding of what it would be like to be a trans woman, but also just a ton of compassion for what that must be like. So he's presenting some of the worst shit imaginable in a way where you're like, yeah, but Dill, she seems like she's really going through it, you know?
It's you know, Oliver, you made a incredibly valid point of, you know, we need to be making more films and media about trans people being loved and not being rejected. But I also think that this movie in 92 is kind of trying to wrestle with those ideas, which to some degree is a worthy thing. The problem, that obvious, not to state the obvious, the problem is we have not made nearly enough progress since 1992.
I've been thinking a lot about you and Kenny's episode in 99 about Boys Don't Cry, which is a movie that in 1999 is like breaking new ground in a weird way. Yeah. And now we see like all the problems with it. And I feel similarly that this movie in 1992 is weirdly positive toward trans people. Like, it has tons of problems, but compared to every other portrayal of trans people at that time, it's head and shoulders above them. And I think it is worth remembering that it, in that context, while also embracing all of the problems that came with the ways it talked about us.
I couldn't have said it better. Boys Don't Cry continues to be a upsetting and powerful film in its own way, but it's obviously got all sorts of problems mixed into it too. I'm genuinely excited and hopeful for where we can go in media, but it's complicated. And I think that people, there's this inherent rejection of, you know, all of this stuff. But let's rate this film, which is, I'm very curious to see how this goes. Basically, we rate our films on this podcast from 0 to 99, 0 being the lowest, 99 being the highest. We rate it from before the podcast and after the podcast, as though this conversation potentially could have swayed people one way or the other. It sometimes does, it sometimes doesn't. I came into this podcast at like a 68. I'm still kind of there. I don't know that I can really give this film, it's just really messy and complicated. And then on a purely like take away all of the messaging of this film, I also don't necessarily feel like the character arcs are particularly delineated well. Like, I don't know that like the thriller aspects and the love story, like it's just, it's doing too much stuff to totally stick the landing. So I'm going to stick at a 68, but where are you, Emily?
I'm going to say I watched this in the early 90s because I knew the twist. And I was like, well, that's interesting. That's fascinating. Mm-hmm. What an interesting twist for your movie. What a cool thing.
I wonder what.
And at the time, I really loved it. I probably would have been like 85 you know, somewhere
okay,
in that range.
Okay.
Now I'm not as hype about it. It has a lot of big problems. I actually think I'm more interested in the screenplay than you are. I think there's some compelling ideas in it. So I'm going to go 72. I'm going to be the high one in this episode. I just know it. It never happens. But it's
Actually, I think it happened for Poison Ivy. But
another weird problematic movie that Emily's like, but you got to admit. The queer phobia scale is infinity.
Yeah, I was going to say, where is this movie on that? Is it Uncharted?
It's infinity. Yes.
Oliver, where are you?
I'm trying to figure out how I want to rate it. I mean, I think that should you watch it today perspective, like probably not. Sure. And so I'm gonna say that I'm gonna give it like a 50.
Sure.
I'm so conflicted about it. You know, if you kind of want to understand like historical attitudes about like trans people, I think it's worth watching if you're interested in that specifically. But I think if not, you probably shouldn't watch it.
Yeah, that sounds right. Caitlin, what about you?
I will say this is probably my second favorite IRA movie of all time. Behind, of course, The Patriot Games, in which I believe Sean Bean dies again. Yes. I probably came into this podcast rating it a 69 because it's the funniest number.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. Incredible.
There you go.
Brilliant.
And I think... I don't watch a lot of movies that like predate 1999. Like I was born in 82, so I turned 18 in 2000. So really my movies before 99 or so, when I got a car for the first time, were like child movies. Like you mentioned, The Mighty Ducks came up earlier. And I was like, oh yeah, I saw that in films. That was great. Like, hell yeah. Like, it's still one of my favorite movies of all time. So I it was interesting watching just an older film. And the one thing I will say about this film, I don't think I have a different post podcast rating for this, but it has made me more interested in like going back and watching, you know, late 80s, early 90s movies, because I'm just so tired of modern movies. Like, I was really into Marvel at one point, and like I'm so burnt out on that. Like, I need an intellectually stimulating like story, and this gave it to me, and I will give it that. So I differ with my podcast partner, I think, on that. Final verdict is it's slightly canceled, I think.
You mentioned your podcast, so please tell us where people can find you and listen to you and hear you cancel things all over the place.
Oliver, you want to take this one?
You can find Cancel Me Daddy wherever you listen to podcasts. So wherever you're listening to this right now, you can probably find it, and hope you enjoy.
It is a really great show. There's a really great episode where you talk to Emily St. James, which I highly recommend.
She sounds great.
Everyone.
It's true.
That's one of my favorite episodes.
It's literally
still
one of my favorite episodes. Yeah, it's so good. It's top five easy.
Thank you.
Also rating that episode a 69, by the way.
Ooh. I gotta say, before we were up, the only movie I've given a 69 on this podcast and the only one I ever will is Single White Female, because it feels perfect for that movie.
It does. It's the only score.
Please come back and join us and talk about a movie that is less fraught than The Crying Game.
Yeah, we need to have you on to just like, so we can just outright have fun and cancel something.
We're canceling Beethoven.
Oh my!
Listen, God. Don't you know?
Hit us up when you do the Danish Girl.
Oh God. Ooh. I haven't seen The Danish Girl, and I have no interest in seeing this.
I actually did. I did a like a hate watch for surgery, like crowdfunding money at one point. I did like this live thread hate watch of the Danish girl. It was great, good times.
That sounds actually kind of amazing.
Yeah.
It sounds kind of, the only way to watch the Danish girl is to hate watch the Danish girl.
That's a great outline, but, Phil. Right.
Yeah. Thank you so much, guys, for coming
thank
on and talking with us about this very tricky movie. So we very much appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having
guys.
Us.
Bye.
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 Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.